nor in the earth itself. He turned his mind to more important matters. First, he had to find a corner to pee into before his bladder burst. He'd never had to crouch and pee at the same time before. But if the air was all right and they lasted for a while, something was going to have to be done with their waste. He didn't like the idea of crawling through his own, much less anyone else's. The floor was of concrete, but it had cracked wide open during the tremors. He recalled he'd felt a garden hoe in the debris that might be useful in digging a latrine. And he was going to search the basement from one end to the other on his hands and knees, gathering up all the cans and everything else he could find. They obviously had plenty of food, and the cans would contain enough water and juices to keep them for a while. It was light he wanted more than anything else, and he'd never known how much he could miss electricity. He crawled into a far corner to relieve himself. Going to be a long time before your next bath, he thought. Won't be needing sunglasses any time soon, either. He winced. The urine burned like battery acid spewing out of him. But I'm alive, he reassured himself. There might not be a whole hell of a lot to live for, but I'm alive. Tomorrow I may be dead, but today I'm alive and pissing on my knees. And for the first time since the blast, he allowed himself to dream that somehow, some way, he might live to see the outside world again. Chapter 18. The dark came with no warning. December's chill was in the July air, and a black, icy rain continued to fall on the ruins of Manhattan. Sister Creep and Artie Wisco stood together atop a ridge of wreckage and looked west. Fires were still burning across the Hudson River and the oil refineries of Hoboken and Jersey City, but other than the orange flames, the west was without light. Raindrops pattered on the warped, gaily colored umbrella that Artie had found in what remained of a sporting goods store. The store had also yielded up other treasures. A day-glow orange nylon knapsack strapped to Artie's back, and a new pair of sneakers on Sister Creep's feet. In the Gucci bag around her shoulder was a charred loaf of rye bread, two cans of anchovies with the handy keys that rolled the lids back, a package of ham slices that had cooked in the plastic, and a miraculously unbroken bottle of Canada Dry ginger ale that had survived the destruction of a deli. It had taken them several hours to cover the terrain between Upper Fifth Avenue and their first destination, the Lincoln Tunnel. But the tunnel itself had collapsed, and the river had flooded right up to the toll gates along with a wave of crushed cars, concrete slabs, and corpses. They had turned away in silence. Sister Creep had led Artie southward toward the Holland Tunnel and another route under the river. Darkness had fallen before they'd made it, and now they'd have to wait until morning to find out if the Holland had collapsed as well. The last street sign that Sister Creep had found said West 22nd, but it was lying on its side in the ashes and could have blown far from where that street had actually been. "Well," Artie said quietly, staring across the river, "don't look like anybody's home, does it?" "No," Sister Creep shivered and drew the mink coat tighter around her. "It's gotten colder. We're going to have to find some shelter." She looked through the darkness at the vague shapes of the few structures that hadn't been toppled. Any one of them might fall on their heads. But Sister Creep didn't like the way the temperature was dropping. "Come on," she said, and she started walking toward one of the buildings. Artie followed her without question. During their journey, they had found only four other people who hadn't been killed in the detonation, and three of those had been so mangled they were very near death. The fourth was a terribly burned man in a pinstriped business suit who had howled like a dog when they'd approached and had scuttled back into a crevice to hide. So Sister Creep and Artie had gone on, walking over so many bodies that the horror of death lost its impact. Now they were shocked whenever they heard a groan in the rubble or, as had happened once, someone laughing and shrieking off in the distance. They had gone in the direction of the voice, but they'd seen no one living. The mad laughter haunted Sister Creep. It reminded her of the laughter she'd heard inside that theater from the man with the burning hand. "There are others still alive out there," he'd said, "waiting to die. It won't be long. Not long for you, either.
We'll see about that, fucker, Sister Creep said.
What? Artie asked.
Oh, nothing. I was just thinking.
Thinking, she realized. Thinking was not something she did much of. The last several years were blurred, and beyond those was a darkness broken only by the flashing blue light and the demon in the yellow raincoat.
My real name's not Sister Creep, she thought suddenly. My real name is...
But she didn't know what it was, and she didn't know who she was or where she'd come from.
How did I get here? She asked herself.
But she could provide no answer. They entered the remains of a gray stone building by climbing up a rubble heap and crawling through a hole in the wall. The interior was pitch dark and the air was dank and smoky, but at least they were within a windbreak. They groped their way along a tilting floor until they found a corner. When they'd gotten settled, Sister Creep reached into her bag to bring out the loaf of bread and the bottle of ginger ale. Her fingers grazed the circle of glass which she'd wrapped up in a scorched striped shirt she'd taken off a mannequin. The other pieces of glass, wrapped in a blue scarf, were down at the bottom of the bag. Here, she tore off a piece of the bread and gave it to Artie, then tore a piece for herself. There was only a burned taste, but it was better than nothing. She unscrewed the cap off the bottle of ginger ale, and the soda instantly foamed up and spewed everywhere. She quickly put it to her mouth, drank several swallows, and passed the bottle to Artie.
I hate ginger ale, Artie said after he'd finished drinking, but this is the best damned stuff I ever drank in my life.
Don't drink it all, she decided against opening the anchovies, because their saltiness would only make them more thirsty. The slices of ham were too precious to eat yet. She gave him another small bit of bread, took another for herself, and put the loaf away.
Know what I had for dinner the night before it happened? Artie asked her. A steak? A big T-bone steak at a place on East 50th. Then some of the guys and me started hitting the bars. That was a night, I'll tell you. We had a hell of a time.
Good for you.
Yeah. What were you doing that night?
Nothing special, she said. I was just around. Artie was quiet for a while, chewing on his bread. Then he said,
I called my wife before I left the hotel. I guess I told her a whopper, 'cause I said I was going to go out and have a nice dinner and come back to bed. She said for me to be careful, and she said she loved me. I told her I loved her and that I'd see her in a couple of days.
He was silent, and when he sighed, Sister Creep heard his breath hitch.
Jesus, he whispered, I'm glad I called her. I'm glad I got to hear her voice before it happened. Hey, lady, well, what if Detroit got hit, too?
Got hit? What do you mean, got hit?
A nuclear bomb, he said. What else do you think could have done this? A nuclear bomb? Maybe more than one. The things probably fell all over the country, probably hit all the cities in Detroit, too.
His voice was getting hysterical, and he forced himself to wait until he was under control again.
Damned Russians bombed us, lady. Don't you read the papers?
No, I don't.
What have you been doing, living on Mars? Anybody who reads the papers and watches the tube could have seen this shit coming. The Russians bombed the hell out of us, and I guess we bombed the hell out of them, too.
A nuclear bomb, she thought. She hardly remembered what that was. Nuclear war was something she'd worried about in another life.
I hope, if they got Detroit, that she went fast. I mean, that's okay to hope for, isn't it? That she went fast without pain?
Yes. I think that's all right.
Is it okay that I told her a lie? It was a white lie. I didn't want her to be worried about me. She worries that I'm going to drink too much and make a fool of myself. I can't hold my liquor too good. Is it okay that I told her a white lie that night?
She knew he was begging her to say it was all right.
Sure,
she told him.
A lot of people did worse things that night. She went to sleep without worrying, didn't...
Something sharp pricked Sister Creep's left cheek.
Don't move, a woman's voice warned. Don't even breathe.
The voice shook. Whoever was speaking was scared to death.
Who's there?
Artie asked, startled almost out of his skin.
Hey, lady, you okay?
I'm okay,
Sister Creep answered. She reached up to her cheek and felt a jagged, knife-like piece of glass.
I said, don't move.
The glass jabbed her.
How many are with you?
Just one more.
Artie Wisco. My name's Artie Wisco. Where are you?
There was a long pause. Then the woman said,
you've got food?
Yes.
Water?
It was a man's voice this time, further to the left.
Have you got water?
Not water, ginger ale.
Let's see what they look like, Beth,
the man said. A lighter's flame popped up, so bright in the darkness that Sister Creep had to close her eyes against the glare for a few seconds. The woman held the flame closer to Sister Creep's face, then toward Artie.
I think they're all right,
she told the man, who moved into the range of the light. Sister Creep could make out the woman, crouched next to her. Her face was swollen and there was a gash across the bridge of her nose, but she appeared to be young. Maybe in her mid-twenties, with a few remaining ringlets of curly light brown hair dangling from her blistered scalp. Her eyebrows had been burned off, and her dark blue eyes were puffy and bloodshot. She was a slim woman, and she wore a blue striped dress that was splotched with blood. Her long, frail arms seethed with blisters. Draped around her shoulders was what looked like part of a gold-colored curtain. The man wore the rags of a cop's uniform. He was older, possibly in his late 30s, and most of his dark crew-cut hair remained on the right side of his head. On the left, it had been burned away to raw scalp. He was a big, heavy-set man, and his left arm was wrapped up and supported in a sling made of that same coarse gold material.
"My God!" Artie said. "Lady, we found a cop!"
"Where'd you two come from?"
Beth asked her.
"Out there. Where else?"
"What's in the bag?"
the woman nodded toward it.
"Are you asking me or mugging me?"
She hesitated, glanced at the policeman and then back at Sister Creep, and lowered the piece of glass. She stuck it through a sash tied around her waist.
"I'm asking you. Burned bread, a couple of cans of anchovies, and some ham slices."
Sister Creep could almost see the young woman start salivating. She reached in and brought out the bread.
"Here. Eat it in good health."
Beth tore off a chunk and handed the dwindling loaf to the policeman, who also gouged off some and stuffed it into his mouth as if it were God's manna.
"Please,"
Beth said, and she reached for the ginger ale. Sister Creep obliged her, and by the time she and the policeman had both had a taste, there were maybe 3 good swallows left.
"All the water's contaminated," Beth told her. "One of us drank some from a puddle yesterday. He started throwing up blood last night. It took him almost 6 hours to die. I've got a watch that still works, see?"
She proudly showed Sister Creep her Timex. The crystal was gone, but that old watch was still ticking. The time was 8:22.
"One of us," she'd said. "How many more people are here?"
Sister Creep asked.
2 more. Well, really 1. The Spanish woman. We lost Mr. Kaplan last night. He drank the water. The boy died yesterday, too, and Mrs. Ivers died in her sleep. There are 4 of us left.
3, the policeman said.
Yeah. Right. 3 of us left. The Spanish woman's down in the basement. We can't get her to move, and neither of us understand Spanish. Do you?
No.
Sorry. I'm Beth Phelps, and he's Jack.
She couldn't remember his last name and shook her head.
Jack Tomacek, he supplied.
Artie reintroduced himself, but Sister Creep said,
"Why aren't you people up here instead of in the basement?"
"It's warmer down there," Jack told her, "and safer, too."
"Safer? How's that?"
"If this old building shifts again, it'll come down on your heads."
"We were up here yesterday," Beth explained. "The boy,
He was about 15, I guess, was the strongest of us. He was Ethiopian or something, and he could only speak a little English. He went out to find food, and he brought back some cans of corned beef hash, cat food, and a bottle of wine, but they followed him back here. They found us.
They?
Artie asked.
They who? Three of them burned so bad you couldn't tell if they were men or women. They followed him back here, and they were carrying hammers and broken bottles. One of them had an axe. They wanted our food. The boy fought them, and the one with the axe...
She trailed off, her eyes glassy and staring at the orange flame of the lighter in her hand.
They were crazy, she said. They weren't human. One of them cut me across the face. I guess I was lucky. We ran from them, and they took our food. I don't know where they went, but I remember they smelled like burned cheeseburgers. Isn't that funny? That's what I thought of, burned cheeseburgers. So we went down in the basement to hide. There's no telling what other kinds of things are out there.
You don't know the half of it, Sister Creep thought. I tried to fight them off, Jack said, but I guess I'm not in fighting shape anymore. He turned around, and both Sister Creep and Artie flinched. Jack Tomachek's back, from shoulders to waist, was a scarlet, suppurating mass of burned tissue. He turned to face them again.
Worst fucking sunburn this old Pollock ever got.
He smiled bitterly.
We heard you up here, Beth told them. At first we thought those things had come back. We came up to listen, and we heard you eating. Listen, the Spanish woman hasn't eaten either. Can I take her some bread?
Take us to the basement.
Sister Creep got to her feet.
I'll open up the ham.
Beth and Jack led them into a hallway. Water was streaming down from above, forming a large black pool on the floor. Through the hallway, a flight of wooden stairs without a banister descended into the darkness. The staircase shook precariously under their feet. It did seem warmer, if only by 5 or 6 degrees in the basement, though exhaled breath was still visible. The stone walls were still holding together, and the ceiling was mostly intact, but for a few holes that let rainwater seep through. This was an old building, Sister Creep thought, and they didn't put them up like this anymore. Stone pillars set at intervals supported the ceiling. Some of those were riddled with cracks, but none of them had collapsed. Yet, Sister Creep told herself.
There she is.
Beth walked toward a figure huddled at the base of one of the pillars. Black water was streaming down right over the figure's head. She was sitting in a spreading pool of contaminated rain, and she was holding something in her arms. Beth's lighter went out.
Sorry, she said. It gets too hot to hold, and I don't want to use up all the fluid. It was Mr. Kaplan's.
What did you do with the bodies?
We took them away. This place is full of corridors. We took them way down to the end of one and left them. I wanted to say a prayer over them, but...
But what?
I forgot how to pray, she replied.
Praying just didn't seem to make much sense anymore.
Sister Creep grunted and reached into her bag for the package of ham slices. Beth bent down and offered the bottle of ginger ale to the Spanish woman. Rainwater splattered her hand.
Here, she said, it's something to drink. El drinko.
The Spanish woman made a whimpering, crooning sound but didn't respond.
She won't move away from there, Beth said. The water's getting all over her, and she won't move 6 feet to a dry place.
Do you want food?
She asked the Spanish woman.
Eat, eat.
Christ, how can you live in New York City without knowing English?
Sister Creep got most of the plastic peeled away from the ham. She tore off a piece and bent on her knees beside Beth Phelps.
Use your lighter again. Maybe if she sees what we've got, we can pull her away from there.
The lighter flared. Sister Creep looked into the blistered but still pretty face of a Hispanic girl who was maybe all of 20. Her long black hair was crisped on the ends, and there were raw holes here and there on her scalp where circles of hair had been burned away. The woman paid no attention to the light. Her large, liquid brown eyes were fixed on what she cuddled in her arms.
"Oh," Sister Creep said softly. "Oh, no."
The child was maybe 3 years old, a girl, with glossy black hair like her mother's. Sister Creep couldn't see the child's face. She didn't want to. But one small hand was rigidly curled as if reaching up for her mother, and the stiffness of the corpse in the woman's arms told Sister Creep that the child had been dead for some time. The water was leaking down through a hole in the ceiling, running through the Spanish woman's hair and over her face like black tears. She began to croon gently, lovingly rocking the corpse.
"She's out of her mind," Beth said. "She's been like that since the child died last night. If she doesn't get out of that water, she's going to die too."
Sister Creep heard Beth only vaguely, as if from a vast distance. She held out her arms toward the Spanish woman.
"Here," she said, in what sounded like a stranger's voice, "I'll take her. Give her to me."
Rainwater ran down her hands and arms in streaks of ebony. The Spanish woman's crooning got louder.
"Give her to me. I'll take her."
The Spanish woman began to rock the corpse more furiously.
"Give her to me."
Sister Creep heard her own voice echo crazily, and suddenly there was a flashing blue light in her eyes.
"I'll take her."
The rain was falling, and thunder rumbled like the voice of God. You sinner, you drunken sinner, you've killed her, and now you have to pay." She looked down. In her arms was the corpse of a little girl. There was blood in the child's blonde hair, and the little girl's eyes were open and full of rain. The blue light of the state trooper car was spinning, and the trooper in the yellow raincoat who was crouched on the road in front of her said gently, "Come on. You have to give her to me now." He looked back over his shoulder at the other trooper who was setting out flares near the wreckage of an overturned car. "She's out of her mind. I can smell alcohol, too. You're going to have to help me." And then they were both reaching toward her, both of the demons in yellow raincoats trying to take her baby. She recoiled and fought them, screaming,
"No! You can't have her! I won't let you have her!"
But the thunder commanded, "Give her up, you sinner, give her up." And when she cried out and put her hands over her ears to block off the voice of judgment, they took her baby away from her. And from the little girl's hand fell a globe of glass, the kind of trinket that holds a little snow scene within it, a make-believe village in a fairy tale land.
"Mommy,"
she remembered the child saying excitedly,
"look what I won at the party. I pinned the tail on the donkey the best."
The child had shaken the globe, and for a moment, just a moment, her mother had looked away from the road to focus her blurred vision on the scene of snow falling amid the roofs of a distant and perfect land. She watched the glass globe fall in terrible slow motion, and she screamed because she knew it was about to break on the concrete, and when it broke, everything would be gone and destroyed. It hit in front of her, and as it shattered into a thousand pieces of glittering junk, her scream stopped with a strangled moan.
"Oh," she whispered, "oh, no."
Sister Creep stared at the dead child in the Spanish woman's arms.
"My little girl is dead," she remembered. "I was drunk, and I picked her up at a birthday party, and I drove right off the road into a ditch. Oh, God, oh, dear Jesus. A sinner. A drunken, wicked sinner. I killed her. I killed my little girl. Oh, God. Oh, God, forgive me."
Tears scorched her eyes and ran down her cheeks. In her mind whirled fragments of memory like dead leaves in a high wind, her husband wild with rage, cursing her and saying he never wanted to see her again, her own mother looking at her with disgust and pity and telling her she was never meant to bear a child, the doctor at the sanitarium nodding his head and checking his watch, the halls of the hospital, where grotesque, shambling, insane women chattered and shrieked and fought one another over combs, and the high fence that she had climbed over in the dead of night and in swirling snow, to reach the woods beyond.
"My little girl is dead," she thought. "Dead and gone a long time ago."
The tears almost blinded her, but she saw well enough to know that her little girl hadn't suffered as this one in the Spanish woman's arms had. Her little girl had been laid to rest under a shade tree atop a hill. This one would lie forever in a cold, damp basement in a city of the dead. The Spanish woman lifted her head and looked at Sister Creep through haunted eyes. She blinked and slowly reached through the rain to touch Sister Creep's cheek. A tear balanced on the tip of her finger for a second before it dropped.
"Give her to me," Sister Creep whispered. "I'll take her."
The Spanish woman looked again, longingly, at the corpse, and then the tears ran from her eyes and mingled with the black rain on her face. She kissed the dead child's forehead, cradled it against her for a moment, and then she held the corpse toward Sister Creep. She took the body as if she was accepting a gift and started to stand up. But the Spanish woman reached out again and touched the crucifix-shaped wound at Sister Creep's neck. She said wonderingly,
"Bendito, muy bendito."
Sister Creep stood up, and the Spanish woman slowly crawled out of the water and lay on the floor, huddled and shivering. Jack Tomacek took the corpse from Sister Creep and went off into the darkness. Beth said,
"I don't know how, but you did it."
She bent down to offer the Spanish woman the bottle of ginger ale. The woman took it from Beth and finished it.
"My God," Artie Wisco said, standing behind her. "I just realized, I don't even know your name."
"It's..."
"What?" she wondered.
"What's my name? Where do I come from? Where is that shade tree that shelters my little girl?"
None of the answers would come to her.
"You can call me..."
She hesitated. "I'm a bag lady," she thought. "I'm nothing but a bag lady with no name, and I don't know where I'm going. But at least I know how I got here."
"Sister," she replied. "You can call me Sister."
And it came to her like a shout.
"I'm not crazy anymore."
"Sister,"
Artie repeated. He pronounced it Sister.
"That ain't much of a name, but I guess it'll do. Glad to know you, Sister."
He nodded, the shadowy memory still whirling. The pain of what she'd remembered was still with her and would remain. But that had happened a long time ago, to a weaker and more helpless woman.
"What are we going to do?" Beth asked. "We can't just stay here, can we?" "No, we can't. Tomorrow, Artie and I are going through the Holland Tunnel. If it hasn't caved in, we're walking west. If you three want to go with us, you're welcome."
"Leave New York? What if there's nothing out there? What if everything's gone?"
"It won't be easy," Sister said firmly. "It'll be damned hard and damned dangerous. I don't know what the weather's going to do, but we start with one step, and that's the only way I know to get anywhere, right?"
"Right,"
Artie echoed.
"You've got good shoes, Beth. Those shoes will take you a long way."
"We've got a long way to go," Sister considered, "a very long way, and God only knows what we'll find out there, or what will find us."
"Okay," Beth decided. "Okay, I'm with you."
She put the flame of her lighter out again to save fuel. But this time, it didn't seem nearly as dark. 4. Land of the Dead. The biggest tomb in the world. Belly of the beast. The most wonderful light. Summer's over. Tunnel trolls. Protect the child. Dream walking. New turn of the game. Chapter 19. The man with the bloody strips of shirt bandaged around the stump of his right wrist moved cautiously along the wrecked corridor. He didn't want to fall down and start that stump bleeding again. It had been dribbling for hours before it had finally crusted over. He was weak and lightheaded, but he pushed himself onward because he had to see for himself. His heart was pounding, and the blood sang in his ears. But what his senses fixed on was an acute itching between the first and second fingers of the right hand that wasn't there anymore. The itching of that phantom hand was about to drive him crazy. Beside him was the one-eyed hunchback, and in front of him, carrying the flashlight and negotiating a path, was the boy with the cracked eyeglasses. In his left hand, the boy gripped a meat cleaver, its blade rimmed with Colonel Jimbo Macklin's dried blood. Roland Croninger stopped, the beam of his light spearing through the haze before him.
"There it is," Teddy Bear said. "There it is, see? I told you, didn't I? I told you."
Macklin moved forward a few paces and took the flashlight from Roland. He played it over the wall of boulders and slabs that completely blocked the corridor in front of them, looking for a chink, a weak place, an area to apply leverage, anything. There wasn't a space large enough for a rat to squeeze through.
"God help us," Macklin said quietly.
"I told you, see? Didn't I tell you?"
Teddy Bear Warner babbled. Finding this blockage had snapped the last of the willpower that was holding him together. Beyond that wall of rock lay Earth House's emergency food supply and equipment room. They were cut off from everything. The spare flashlights, the batteries, toilet paper, flares, everything.
"We're fucked," Teddy Bear giggled. "Oh, are we fucked?"
Dust filtered down through the flashlight beam. Macklin raised it and saw the jagged fissures that cleaved the corridor ceiling. Most of the corridor might cave in at any time. Cables and wires dangled, and the iron reinforcement beams that were supposed to have supported Earth House through a nuclear attack were entirely cut through. Teddy Bear's giggling was mixed with sobs, and as Macklin realized the full extent of the disaster, he could no longer stand the sound of human weakness. He ground his teeth, his face contorting in rage, and he turned to strike Teddy Bear across the face with his itching right hand. But he had no right hand, and as he reared his arm back, there was a searing, ripping pain, and fresh blood dripped through the bandages. Macklin cradled his injured arm against his body and squeezed his eyes tightly shut. He felt sick, about to throw up or pass out. Discipline and control, he thought. Shape up, soldier, shape up, damn you. "When I open my eyes again," he told himself, "that wall of rock won't be there. We'll be able to walk right on through the corridor to where the food is. We'll be okay. Please, God, please make everything okay." He opened his eyes. The wall of rock remained. "Anybody got any plastic explosive?" Macklin asked. His voice echoed in the corridor. It was a lunatic voice. The voice of a man down in the bottom of a muddy pit with bodies sprawled all around him.
"We're going to die,"
Teddy Bear said, giggling and sobbing, his one good eye wild.
"We've got the biggest tomb in the world."
"Colonel?" It was the boy speaking. Macklin shone the light in Roland's face. It was a dusty, blood-spattered, emotionless face.
"We've got hands," Roland said.
"Hands, sure. I've got one hand, you've got two. Teddy Bears, two aren't worth shit." "Sure, we've got hands."
"Not our hands," Roland replied calmly. An idea had come to him, clear and precise. "Their hands. The ones who are still alive up there."
"The civilians?" Macklin shook his head. "We probably couldn't find 10 men able to work. And look at that ceiling. See those cracks? The rest of it's about to fall. Who's going to work with that hanging over their heads?"
"How far is it from the wall to the food?"
"I don't know. Maybe 20 feet, maybe 30.
Roland nodded.
"What if we tell them it's 10 feet? And what if they don't know about the ceiling? Do you think they'd work or not?"
Macklin hesitated.
This is a kid, he thought. What does this kid know about anything?
"We three are going to die," Roland said, "if we can't get to that food. And we won't get there if we can't make someone else do the work.
Maybe the ceiling will fall, maybe it won't. But if it does fall, we won't be the ones underneath it, will we?
They'll know the ceiling's weak. All they have to do is look up and see those goddamn cracks.
They can't see them, Roland said quietly. In the dark. And you're holding the only light, aren't you?
A smile touched the corners of his mouth. Macklin blinked slowly. There seemed to be a movement in the gloom over Roland Croninger's shoulder. Macklin adjusted the flashlight beam a few degrees. Crouched down on his haunches was the Shadow Soldier, wearing his camouflage uniform with a helmet with green netting. Beneath the black and green war paint, his face was the color of smoke.
"The boy's right, Jimbo,"
the Shadow Soldier whispered. He rose to his full height.
"Make the civilians do the work. Make them work in the dark and tell them it's only 10 feet to the food. Shit, tell them it's 6 feet. They'll work harder. And if they break through, fine. If not, they're only civilians, drones, breeders, right?"
"Yes, sir," Macklin answered.
"Huh?" Roland saw that the colonel seemed to be looking at something just over his right shoulder, and he was using that same fawning voice that he'd used when he was in delirium down in the pit. Roland looked around, but of course there was nothing there.
"Drones," Macklin said. "Breeders."
"Right."
He nodded and pulled his attention away from the Shadow Soldier back to the boy.
"Okay. We'll go up and see if we can find enough to make a work detail. Maybe some of my men are still alive, too."
He remembered Sergeant Shore running wildly from the command center.
"Shore? What the hell happened to him?"
Teddy Bear shook his head. "What about Dr. Lang? Is he still alive?"
"He wasn't in the infirmary."
Teddy Bear made an effort not to look at that wall of rock.
"I didn't check his quarters."
"We'll check them, then. We may need him and whatever painkillers he can scrounge up. I'm going to need more bandages, too, and we need bottles, plastic bottles, if we can find them. We can get water out of the toilets."
"Colonel, sir?"
Roland immediately got Macklin's full attention.
"One more thing. The air."
"What about the air?"
"The generator's out. The electrical system's gone. How are the fans going to pull air into the vents?"
Macklin had been building a hope, however faint, that they might survive. Instantly, it crumbled. Without the fans, no air would be circulated through Earth House. The dank air that Earth House now held would be all they could expect, and when the carbon dioxide levels grew high enough, they would die. But how long would that take? He didn't know. Hours, days, weeks? He couldn't let himself think beyond the moment. And the most important thing right now was finding a drink of water, a bite of food, and a work detail.
"We've got plenty of air," he said. "Enough for everybody. And by the time it starts getting thin, we'll have found a way out of here, right?"
Roland wanted to believe, and he nodded. Behind him, the Shadow Soldier nodded too and said to Macklin,
"Good boy."
The colonel checked his own quarters just up the corridor. The door had been torn off its hinges, and part of the ceiling had collapsed. A hole had opened in the floor, swallowing his bed and the bedside table in its depths. The bathroom was a wreck as well, but Macklin's flashlight found a few handfuls of water remaining in the toilet bowl. He drank from it, and then Roland and Teddy Bear took their turns. Water had never tasted so sweet. Macklin went to the closet. Everything had collapsed inside and lay on the floor in a heap. He got down on his knees and, holding the flashlight in the crook of his arm, began to go through the mess, looking for something he knew must be there. It took him a while to find it.
"Roland," he said, "come here."
The boy stood behind him.
"Yes, sir."
Macklin gave him the small Ingram machine gun that had been on the closet shelf.
"You're in charge of that."
He stuffed bullet clips into the pockets of his flight jacket. Roland slid the handle of the holy axe down inside his belt and held the Ingram gun in both hands. It wasn't heavy, but it felt righteous.
Yes, righteous and important, like some vital signet of empire that a king's knight ought to be in charge of.
"Do you know anything about guns?" Macklin asked him.
My dad takes me...
Roland stopped. No, that wasn't right.
Not right at all. I used to go shooting at a target range, he replied. But I've never used anything like this.
I'll teach you what you need to know. You're going to be my trigger finger when I need one. He shone the light at Teddy Bear, who was standing a few feet away and listening. This boy stays near me from now on, he told Teddy Bear, and the other man nodded but said nothing. Macklin didn't trust Teddy Bear anymore. Teddy Bear was too close to going over the edge. But not the boy. Oh, no. The boy was strong-minded and smart, and it had taken sheer guts for him to crawl down into that pit and do what had to be done. The kid looked like a 90-pound weakling, but if he was going to crack, he would have cracked by now. Roland put the gun sling around his shoulder and adjusted it so it was tight and he could get to the weapon in a hurry. Now he was ready to follow the king anywhere. Faces surfaced from the muddy waters of his memory, a man and a woman, but he pushed them down again. He didn't want to remember those faces anymore. There was no use for it, and it only weakened him. Macklin was ready.
Okay, he said. Let's see what we can find. And the one-eyed hunchback and the boy with cracked eyeglasses followed him into the darkness.
Chapter 20 Lady, Jack Tomachek said, if you think we can get through that, you belong in Bellevue. Sister didn't reply. A bitter wind was blowing in her face off the Hudson River, and she narrowed her eyes against stinging needles of ice that were whirling down from the black clouds above them, stretching from horizon to horizon like a funeral shroud. Sickly yellow rays of sunlight found holes in the clouds and moved like search lamps from a grade B prison escape movie, then were extinguished when the holes closed. The river itself was turbid with corpses, floating trash and the hulks of burned boats and barges, all moving sluggishly southward to the Atlantic. Across the frightful river, the oil refinery fires were still blazing. The thick black smoke swirled in a maelstrom over the Jersey shore. Behind her stood Artie, Beth Phelps, and the Spanish woman, all of them wrapped up in layers of curtains and coats to ward off the wind. The Spanish woman had cried most of the night, but her eyes were dry now. All her crying was done. Below the ridge they stood on was the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. It was jammed with vehicles whose gas tanks had exploded, but that wasn't the worst of it. The worst, Sister saw, was that the remains of those cars were about wheel-rim deep in dirty Hudson River water. Somewhere inside that long and dark tunnel, the ceiling had ruptured, and the river was streaming in, not enough yet to collapse it like the Lincoln Tunnel, but enough to make the passage a dangerous slog through a swamp of burned cars, bodies, and God only knew what else. I'm not up to swimming, Jack said, or drowning. If that bastard fell in on our heads, we could kiss our asses goodbye.
Okay. What's a better suggestion?
We go east to the Brooklyn Bridge, or we go across the Manhattan Bridge. Anything but in there.
Sister pondered that for a moment. She held her leather bag close to her side, and within it she could feel the outline of the glass circle. Sometime during the long night, she'd had a dream of the thing with the burning hand, stalking through the smoke and ruins, its eyes searching for her. She feared that thing more than the half-flooded tunnel.
What if the bridges are gone?
Huh?
What if both those bridges are gone? She repeated calmly. Look around, and tell me if you think those spindly bridges could survive what blew down the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building.
Well, they might have. We won't know unless we see.
And that'll be another day gone. By that time, the tunnel might be completely flooded. I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't mind getting my feet wet.
Jack shook his head. No way. I'm going in there, lady. And you're nuts if you do. Listen, why do you want to leave Manhattan anyway? We can find food here, and we could go back to the basement. We don't have to leave.
You might not, Sister agreed. I do. There's nothing here.
I'm going with you, Artie said. I'm not afraid.
Who said I was afraid? Jack countered. I'm not afraid. I'm just not fucking crazy is all.
Beth, Sister turned her attention to the young woman. What about you? Are you going with us or not?
She stared fearfully at the clogged tunnel entrance, and finally she replied,
Yes, I'm going with you.
Sister touched the Spanish woman's arm, pointed down at the Holland Tunnel, and made a walking gesture with two fingers. The other woman was still too shocked to respond.
We'll have to stay close together, Sister told Beth and Artie. I don't know how deep the water'll be in there. I think we should link hands and go through so nobody gets lost, okay?
Both of them nodded. Jack snorted.
You're crazy. All of you are out of your minds.
Sister Beth and Artie started down the ridge toward the tunnel entrance. The Spanish woman followed. Jack shouted,
You'll never make it through there, lady.
But the others didn't pause or look back. And after another moment, Jack came down the ridge behind them. Sister stopped in chilly water up to her ankles.
Let me have your lighter, Beth, she said.
Beth gave it to her, but she didn't spark it yet. She took Beth's hand, and Beth grasped Artie's, and Artie held on to the Spanish woman's hand. Jack Tomacek completed the chain.
Okay,
she heard fear in her voice, and she knew she had to take the next step before her nerve broke.
Let's go.
She started walking around the hulks of vehicles into the Holland Tunnel. The water crept up to her knees. Dead rats bobbed in it like corks. Less than 10 feet into the tunnel, the water had risen to her thighs. She flicked the lighter, and its meager flame popped up. The light revealed a nightmarish phantasmagoria of tangled metal before them. Cars, trucks, and taxis torn into half-submerged, otherworldly shapes. The tunnel walls were scorched black and seemed to swallow up the light instead of reflecting it. Sister knew there must have been an ungodly inferno in here when all the gas tanks blew. In the distance, far ahead, she heard the echoing noise of a waterfall. She pulled the human chain onward. Things floated around her that she avoided looking at. Beth gave a little gasp of terror.
Keep going, Sister told her. Don't look around. Keep going.
The water crawled up her thighs.
I stepped on something, Beth cried out. Oh, Jesus, there's something under my foot.
Sister squeezed her hand tightly and guided her on. The water had reached Sister's waist by the time she'd taken another half dozen steps. She looked over her shoulder at the entrance, now about 60 feet behind them, its murky light pulling at her. But she returned her attention to what lay ahead, and immediately her heart stuttered. The lighter's flame glinted off a huge mangled knot of metal that almost completely blocked the tunnel, a pile of what used to be cars melded together by the heat. Sister found a narrow space to slip around, her feet sliding on something slick at the bottom. Now rivulets of water were falling from above, and Sister concentrated on keeping the lighter dry. The waterfall's noise still lay ahead.
It's about to cave in, Jack shouted. God, it's gonna fall in on us. Keep going, Sister yelled at him. Don't stop.
Ahead of them, except for the small glow of the flame, was total, unfathomable darkness. What if it's blocked up, she thought, and she felt the scurrying of panic. What if we can't make it? Settle down, one step at a time, one step. The water reached her waist and continued to climb.
Listen, Beth said suddenly, and she stopped.
Artie bumped into her and almost slipped into the foul water. Sister could hear nothing but the increased rumble of the waterfall. She started to pull Beth on, but then there was a deep groaning noise from above them.
We're in the belly of the beast, Sister thought, like Jonah being swallowed alive.
Something splashed into the water in front of her. Other falling objects banged loudly off the wreckage like the noise of sledgehammers at work. Chunks of stone, Sister realized.
Dear God, The ceiling's about to collapse.
It's falling!
Jack shouted, about to choke on terror. Sister heard him thrashing through the water, and she knew his nerve had given out. She looked back and could see him struggling wildly the way they'd come. He slipped into the water, came up sobbing.
I don't want to die, he screamed. I don't want to die.
And the sound of his screaming trailed away after him.
Don't anybody move, Sister commanded before the others fled too.
Stones were still falling all around, and she clasped Beth's hand so hard her knuckles popped. The chain trembled, but it held. Finally, the stones ceased to fall and the groaning noise stopped too.
Everybody okay? Beth? Artie? Is the woman all right?
Yeah, he answered shakily. I think I've shit in my pants, though.
Shit I can deal with. Panic I can't. Do we go on or not?
Beth's eyes were glassy. She's checked out, Sister thought. Maybe that was for the best.
Artie? You ready?
She asked, and all Artie could do was grunt. They slogged onward through water that rose toward their shoulders. Still, there was no light ahead, no sign of a way out. Sister winced as a piece of stone the size of a manhole cover slammed into a wrecked truck about 10 feet away. The noise of the waterfall was nearer, and over their heads the tunnel groaned with the strain of holding back the Hudson River. She heard a faint voice from behind them.
Come back. Please come back.
She wished Jack Tomachek well. And then the waterfall's roar drowned him out. Her bag was full of water, her clothes pulling heavily at her, but she kept the lighter extended over her head. It was uncomfortably hot in her hand, though she dared not flick the flame off. Sister could see her breath pluming out into the light, the water numbing her legs and stiffening her knees. One more step, she resolved. Then the next. Keep going. They passed another surrealistic heap of melded vehicles, and the Spanish woman cried out in pain as an edge of underwater metal gashed her leg. But she gritted her teeth and didn't falter. A little further on, Artie's feet got tangled up in something, and he went down, coming up sputtering and coughing, but he was okay. And then the tunnel curved, and Sister said, Stop! Before them, glittering in the feeble light, was a torrent of water pouring from above, stretching the width of the tunnel. They would have to pass through the downpour, and Sister knew what that meant.
I'm going to have to put the lighter out now, until we get past, she said. Everybody hold on tight. Ready?
She felt Beth squeeze her hand, and Artie croaked,
Ready?
Sister closed the lighter's lid. The darkness consumed all. Sister's heart was pounding, and she gripped the lighter protectively in her fist and started forward. The water hit her so hard it knocked her under. She lost Beth's hand and heard the young woman scream. Frantically, Sister tried to get her footing, but there was something slick and oozy all over the bottom. Water was in her mouth and eyes. She couldn't draw a breath, and the darkness distorted her sense of direction. Her left foot was trapped and held by an underwater object, and a shriek was very close, but she knew that if she let it go, they were all lost. She flailed around with her free hand, trying to hold the lighter up with the other, and fingers gripped her shoulder.
I've got you,
Beth shouted, her own body being battered by the waterfall. She steadied Sister, who wrenched her leg free with an effort that almost tore the sneaker off her foot. Then she was loose and moving again, guiding the others away from the snag. She didn't know how long it took them to clear the waterfall, maybe 2 minutes, maybe three, but suddenly they were past it, and she wasn't gasping for air anymore. Her skull and shoulders felt as bruised as if she'd been used as a punching bag. She shouted,
We made it!
And led them a distance away before her side bumped metal. Then she took the lighter in her fingers again and tried to strike it. A spark leaped, but there was no flame. Oh, Jesus, Sister thought. She tried it again. Another star of sparks, but no flame and no light.
come on, come on, she breathed. The third time was no charm.
Light, damn you.
But it wouldn't, not on the fourth or fifth attempts, and she prayed that the lighter hadn't gotten too wet to catch. On the eighth try, a small, weak flame appeared, wavered, and almost died again. Fluids almost gone, Sister realized. They had to get out of here before it was used up, she thought, and before that instant she'd never known how sanity could depend on a tiny, flickering flame. Beside her, the crumpled radiator grill and hood of a Cadillac protruded from the water like an alligator's snout. In front of her, another car lay on its roof, all but submerged, the tires shredded from its wheels. They were amid a maze of wreckage, their circle of light cut to a fraction of what had been before. Sister's teeth had begun to chatter. Her legs felt like cold chunks of lead. They went on, step by careful step. The tunnel groaned above them again, and more rubble tumbled down. But suddenly, Sister realized that the water was back down to her waist.
"We're coming out!" she shouted. "Thank God we're coming out!"
She strained to see light ahead, but the exit wasn't yet in sight.
"Don't stop! You're almost there!"
She stumbled over something on the bottom. A gurgle of bubbles exploded in her face, and from the water in front of her rose a corpse, blackened and gnarled like a piece of wood, its arms frozen stiffly over its face, its mouth straining in a soundless scream. The lighter went out. The corpse leaned against Sister's shoulder in the dark. She stood motionlessly, her heart about to burst through her chest, and she knew she could either lose her mind in that moment or... She took a shuddering breath and pushed the thing aside with her forearm. The corpse slid under again with a noise like a giggle.
"I'm going to get us out of here," she heard herself vow,
and in her voice there was a dogged strength she hadn't known she possessed.
"Fuck the dark. We're getting out."
She took the next step, and the next one after that. Slowly, the water descended to their knees, and... how much later and how many steps further, Sister didn't know. She saw the Holland Tunnel's exit before them. They had reached the Jersey Shore. Chapter 21.
"Water. Please, let me have some water."
Josh opened his eyes. Darlene's voice was getting weaker. He sat up and crawled over to where he'd piled up all the cans he'd uncovered. There were dozens of them. Many of them burst open and leaking, but their contents seemed okay. Their last meal had been baked beans washed down with V8 juice, the task of can opening made simpler by a screwdriver he'd discovered. The dirt had also yielded up a shovel with a broken blade and a pickaxe, along with other bits and pieces from the grocery shelves. Josh had put everything in the corner, organizing the tools, large and small cans, with the single-minded concentration of a pack rat. He found the V8 and crawled to Darlene. The exertion left him sweating and tired again, and the smell of the latrine trench he'd dug over on the side of the basement didn't help the air any either. He reached out in the darkness and touched Swan's arm. She was cradling her mother's head. "Here." He tipped the can to Darlene's mouth. She drank noisily for a moment and then pushed the can away.
"Water," she begged. "Please. Some water."
"Oh, I'm sorry, there's not any."
"Shit,"
she muttered.
"I'm burning up."
Josh gently laid a hand on her forehead. It was like touching a griddle, much worse than his own fever. Further away, Pawpaw was still hanging on, intermittently babbling about gophers, his missing truck keys, and some woman named Goldie.
"Blakeman," Darlene croaked. "We gotta get to Blakeman, Swan, honey. Don't you worry. We'll get there." "Yes, ma'am,"
Swan replied quietly, and Josh heard it in her voice. She knew her mother was near death.
"Soon as they come get us out of here,
We'll be on our way. Lord, I can see my daddy's face right now.
She laughed and her lungs gurgled.
Oh,